Welcome to a very special episode of Brandon Novat. We are delighted to have Marlon Engel rejoin us on the show, and I have Travis Timmerman as a guest host. Marlon, would you like to start with a thought experiment? We're going to be talking about the ethics of eating.
Yes, and thank you, Mark and Travis. So I actually have two thought experiments. So the first thought experiment goes like this. So suppose I go to the local animal shelter and I adopt an eight-week-old puppy, a Labrador Retriever puppy named Mocha. And I bring him home and I get out my garden shears and I chop off his tail, I castrate him, and I clip all of his teeth, all without anesthesia. And then I lock him in a small crate that's so small he can barely turn around, and I keep him in the crate for 3 months. And at that point, I pull him out of his feces-encrusted crate, hit him in the head with a hammer to stun him, and then I lower him in a scalding tank of water before dismembering him while he's still alive. Have I done something wrong? And I think it's obvious that I've done something wrong. In fact, were I to do that, that's aggravated animal abuse, at least in the United States. That's a felony in every single state in the U.S. And if people discovered that I had done that, they would want to send me to prison for a very long time. But before you condemn me, you need to find out why I did what I did. I treated Mocha that way because I intend to eat him. And dog meat, dog flesh is a source of protein. Does that justify my behavior? Not one bit. Because I can easily meet all my nutritional needs and all of my protein needs without torturing puppies to death. So that's the first thought experiment. The second thought experiment I call carny. Suppose I didn't treat Mocha so badly in order to eat Mocha myself. I did it for a meat eater named Carney, who's too squeamish to kill her own meat. So she paid me to do it. So I raised Mocha in exactly that same way, treated Mocha in those inhumane ways, and then killed Mocha and sold the meat to Carney. Does that justify my action? No, it only makes Carney complicit. Now that Carney paid me to do it, she too is culpable for the dog's death, just as I would be culpable if I paid a hitman to kill my nasty neighbor. So I think both of those thought experiments show that we think it would be wrong to treat Mocha in that abusive way. And I use those two thought experiments to motivate some common sense principles that I think we're all implicitly committed to. I think the experiment shows that we think it's wrong to harm animals for no good reason, that it's wrong to abuse animals for no good reason, that it's wrong to cause animals to suffer for no good reason, and that it's wrong to kill them for no good reason. And in some of my published work, I have created an acronym for that called HASC, Harm, Abuse, Suffer, Kill. And I refer to a HASC practice as any practice that harms animals, abuses them, causes them to suffer, or kills them for no good reason. And then I go on to argue that all forms of animal agriculture are HASC practices. They cause animals harm, they cause animals to suffer, they kill animals, and it's all done for no good reason because we can easily meet all of our nutritional needs without killing any animals at all. So that's maybe the starting point where we can jump off.
Yeah. So I think the initial pushback that you'd get from a lot of people is the claim that there's no good reason to eat meat that's a product of animal agriculture, even if we grant, as we should, that the typical person can meet all of their nutritional needs by only eating plant-based products. So one thing you might say is maybe collectively, there's no good reason for everybody to partake in animal agriculture. But I want to know what I, as an individual, have good reason to do. And the sad fact of the matter is that most people around me eat meat. It's part of their religious tradition. It's part of their cultural traditions. They have various things that they do that are tied to their identity that they look forward to. That's part of socialization that involves eating meat at every meal. And if I, this hypothetical individual, don't partake in that, then I can miss out on these traditions. I could be ostracized in various ways. I could get made fun of or being accused of being a hypocrite or have to field 20 questions every time I try to sit down and have a meal with people. So why isn't that a good reason to eat meat for me?
So let me just respond with a slightly different case. Presumably there was a time when, for certain people, almost everyone they knew and socialized with owned slaves. And if they spoke out against slavery, they would be ostracized. They would be made fun of. They might be kicked out of their families. But of course, they shouldn't own slaves. They should have done the right thing. So, but you are right to press me on my claim is that a hash practice has to be done for no good reason. Let me say at least what I think, not just any reason is a good reason. Suppose my favorite smell in the world is the smell of puppies being burned alive with a blowtorch. The fur burning and everything. Well, that's a reason to take a blowtorch to puppies, but it's not a good reason. My incredibly trivial interest in a particular olfactory sensation doesn't possibly outweigh the most significant interests of those puppies not to be burned alive. So by a good reason, the reason has to be sufficiently morally weighty to override the most significant interests of an animal. And I think in the end, I think Singer was right. The overwhelming reason that most people eat meat is because they like the taste. They're eating meat because they want a certain gustatory sensation. Well, if an olfactory sensation doesn't justify me in torturing puppies to death, a gustatory sensation doesn't either. But now I'll come back to your point where you say, all my friends eat meat. Well, but I imagine a lot of your friends do other things that you don't do because you think maybe it's foolish to do those things or wrong to do those things. And secondly, if these people are really your friends, they shouldn't cease being your friend just because you choose to want to eat a healthy diet that doesn't contribute to animal suffering and climate change. And as far as cultural traditions go, we can change our traditions. We can improve them. We can make them better. You know, instead of having a big turkey for Thanksgiving, we can plant a fall harvest garden that we all grew together and collect the food and create a new, truly humane way of celebrating and giving thanks. So I guess I'd have to hear more about why you think eating what your family eats is a good reason.
Let me follow up briefly on that, and then I'll let Mark jump in. But So I am lucky in that I have supportive family and friends, and I'm also psychologically atypical. It's a philosopher I quite enjoy having long, extended, argumentative discussions about these issues. But lots of people don't. They want to go home for Thanksgiving and enjoy time with their family and not have someone say, like, why aren't you eating meat now? What if you were on an island with a pig and it was you or the pig? Or people have done this for hundreds of years, or this is grandma's recipe, or we worked so hard over this and now you're not being appreciative of the things that we care about. And, oh, you want to plant a garden? That's stupid. We're not going to do that. Just sit down and have what we've done every year for your life beforehand. They just, of course, understandably, I think, don't want to be subject to that kind of scrutiny about their dietary decisions. And it's much, much easier to not have to constantly get into an argument with these people that you care about. And again, when I say I, this is the impersonal I hypothetical individual. It's not the situation that I'm in, but it's one that many of my students seem to be in, that many of my friends seem to be in. It's a situation that seems rather common.
I guess what I would say is that it's often hard to do what's right. There are many situations where there's pressure on you to do something wrong, but that isn't a good reason to do something wrong. So I'm arguing that it's wrong to eat meat for the reasons I've described, and the fact that other people are doing something wrong doesn't justify me in doing something wrong. Now, if I'm mistaken and it's not wrong, that's one thing. Suppose all my friends use the date rape drug on women and date rape them, and they're pressuring me to do that, and they're encouraging me, like, look, I just don't fit in. You're just some goody two-shoes if you're not doing it. I absolutely shouldn't do it, even if it means losing those people as my friends, because it's horrifically wrong. And I think that there are good reasons to think that raising and killing animals for food and consuming them is a wrong on the same order of magnitude as date rape. You shouldn't participate in it, social pressure aside. And also, as far as the argumentation thing goes, you don't have to engage. You don't have to defend your view. You can just say, this is important to me and I'm not going to eat that food. Or you can say, if it's your family, you can say, look, I'm actually deeply appreciative of you. You taught me how important it is to live in accordance with your values. And that's what I'm doing. You taught me that it's really important to be kind and compassionate and humane and not harm others without good reason. I'm living according to the principles you taught me. So I thank you for that. Oh, and you can leave it at that.
So I want to zero in on an important distinction. It seems like there's things that we're obliged to do, and there are things that it would be good if we did. And there are things that can have an effect in the real world, and the things that are merely symbolic. And so the question is, where does eating meat fall into this? One view might be to say, it is horrendous what happens to animals during factory farming. That you can accept that all of what you've described in your initial thought experiment is exactly what happens to pigs, chickens, and cows every day. And that it's an abominable thing that this is happening. Second is, the way you've set your case up is that there's a direct relationship between the harm caused to animals and the consumer. So in other words, if you're making the fryer dog meat for your friend, and if she weren't buying it, you wouldn't do it, then we can say, well, there's a direct causal relationship. And if you didn't have the demand, you wouldn't have the harm caused. And it just seems that's not the situation we find ourselves in when it comes to factory farm meat. Qua individual choice. So if everybody stopped eating meat, then I agree that factory farms would have absolutely no reason to continue torturing animals to death. But if you make the private choice, it will not have an effect at all. That the scale at which supermarkets and restaurants buy their meat will be unaffected by individual choices. In a similar way that your private vote in an election has almost no chance of tipping the scale one way or the other. That if you live in certain states, for example, you are wasting your vote. If you live in a red state and you vote Democrat, you know that your vote will have no effect whatsoever. You might think that it's a good thing to vote because you're engaged in a symbolic exercise, that it's important to say, I care about democracy, and so I want to show that I'm part of the system and I want to play this role. But I don't think anyone would think you had a moral obligation to vote. They would say, oh, maybe it's a good thing to do and you're engaged in the symbolic activity. But if you said, I don't vote because it has no causal efficacy, I don't think anyone would think that you've done something blameworthy. The only country I'm aware of that punishes you for not voting is Australia. Generally, private choice is seen as quite important. And so if we're in the category where you can recognize that factory farming as a practice is a sinister practice and it would be better for it not to occur, it doesn't get you to the you have an obligation not to eat meat. It might be that it's a good symbolic thing to do. Maybe if you can get enough mass action together, it's a useful thing to do. But as a private choice to say that you must is a much stronger claim.
This is a great question. I'm really glad you asked it. And this in the literature is known as the impotence of the individual objection. And so I think there are actually a number of problems with the objection. And also it's less clear that the objection really applies to me because I'm not giving a consequentialist argument. But let me just start out by saying, first of all, my not buying a chicken sandwich today is one thing that I would do or refrain from doing, let's put it that way, as a vegan. But there's another action that I'm doing. It's the action of becoming and remaining a vegan. So it's an action that I'm doing throughout the rest of my life. So my entire life, I'm reducing the demand for meat by one, what used to be an ordinary American meat eater. So I'm reducing the demand by that amount. That's just how demand is defined by economists. That's something I'm actually succeeding in doing. I am reducing the demand for meat by the amount of meat consumed by a typical normal meat-eating consumer. Now, the next question is, yes, but will that relatively small reduction in demand have any impact on the number of chickens or cows or pigs that are actually raised and produced? And so the claim, the way you framed it, is the answer is no, it'll have zero impact, not any impact at all. So I'm going to just run a thought experiment with you. If that's true, if my being vegan has absolutely zero impact on the number of chickens and cows and pigs raised for eating meat, then Travis's being vegan doesn't have any impact, zero. So if two of us together have zero impact, if all three of us do this, 3 times 0 is 0. So if 100 million Americans decide to go vegan tomorrow and stay vegan, 100 million times 0 is 0. So even with that dramatic reduction in demand, the exact same amount of meat would be produced. But of course, that's obviously false. Since there are about 300 million people in the U.S., if 100 million people went vegan, the number of chickens and cows and pigs would be reduced by at least a third. So it's just false that I make zero impact. I make an imperceptible but positive impact on the number of animals being raised and killed. And when other people do it, they add to that imperceptible impact, and you get enough imperceptible impacts together, and that actually results in a reduction in the number of animals being raised and slaughtered. So I'm making a small, but not zero, impact. And also, I'm not becoming a vegetarian or a vegan in a vacuum. I'm becoming vegetarian and vegan in a society where an increasing number of people are becoming vegetarian and vegan. So I actually have some reason to think that I am contributing to the impact of reducing the number of animals being raised and slaughtered. Other people, Alistair Norcross, Peter Singer, long before Norcross, have pointed out that there has to be some threshold of consumers stopping that'll be tipping points where one chicken factory will be shut down or whatever. And so some people say, yeah, but the odds of you being that one person that reaches the threshold is almost zero. But that's the wrong way to look at it, because suppose I'm the fifth person in the queue and it takes 10,000 to reach the threshold, and we reach it. Well, we wouldn't have reached it. Each one of us is the tipping point, because had any one of us not been in the queue, that 10,000th person wouldn't have been the threshold. So when we reach those thresholds, everybody is equally responsible for that reduction in the amount of, you know, animals being raised and produced.
So I think there's two important points to follow up with respect to this. Causal and efficacy. So one is, I think you're right that it's undeniably true that the group of people who are vegetarian, vegan, pescatarian, reducitarians, freegans, so forth, collectively have a huge net positive impact on animal welfare. If all of them ate meat in the way, just talking about Americans for a minute, as frequently as Americans tend to, there'd be billions of additional animals that were created and subject to torture annually than there in fact are. But the reasoning that you use to get there, I'm not quite sure about for two specific reasons. So one, you said, if I don't make a difference, and then say, Mark doesn't make a difference, and you don't make a difference, then the three of us wouldn't make a difference. And then you could just keep using that chain of reasoning to get that any group, no matter how large, wouldn't make a difference. But I don't think that's right. Or at least we would have to be more clear in how we're cashing out what it means for an individual to make a difference. So it could be the case that I, as an individual, am not making a difference right now when I abstain from purchasing meat. It could be the case that Mark, as an individual, is not. And it could be the case that you're not. And that could be true of every individual that's abstaining from purchasing any animal products right now, even though collectively they do make a difference. So when we're deciding how to act, I think you have to hold fixed how other people are in fact acting to decide what difference your action is going to make or not. So in the a hypothetical case you gave where, say, the threshold is at 1,000. If 1,000 additional people stop purchasing, let's say, chicken from a particular butcher, to use Shelley Kagan's example that he adapted from Singer, and I'm the 55th person or 56th person or something like that that abstains, then it seems like I and each of the other 55 people are, in fact, not difference makers. We could be part of a group that would be a difference maker if a sufficient number of additional people joined, but they're not, and I might be able to reason quite well that they're not going to, you know, join me and the people that are abstaining, and then infer that none of us are, in fact, difference makers. So that's the first thing.
Let me respond to that. So what I would say, I guess it really depends on what you mean by make no difference. When I hear that, I hear you make zero difference. And if that's true of every individual, then there's no way that collectively they're going to make a difference, because add up all the zero differences in the world and you still get zero. The only way mathematically for the collection to make a difference is each one of those individuals is making some small, imperceptible difference. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how many you add together. Zero difference times a million is zero.
Do you think the same thing is true about voting? Like, I voted for Biden in New York in the last presidential election, and I think I made no difference to what I think everyone in New York who voted for Biden made no difference to whether he was elected. But of course, collectively, if none of us had voted for Biden in New York, then he would have lost New York, and that wouldn't have made a difference to whether he became president, but it would have made a difference to the Electoral College votes. But
I think voting is a kind of, if all you care about are outcomes, right, and elections are won by one vote, as long as the person won by more than one vote, an extra vote doesn't affect the outcome. Actually, we care about more than outcomes, because it's always important to people who are elected what percent they won by, so that they can claim, I have a mandate. I won by 58%. I won by whatever percent. And if that matters, then of course each vote matters, because it adds to the percentage. Small, but it adds to the percentage. So it really depends on who you care about. But I also want to mention
That's very helpful.
Yeah, I also want to mention one other thing. I know you have a second point, but I don't want to forget this point. And that is, I think it's important to realize that you can make a causal contribution without making a counterfactual contribution. So imagine that I, along with five other people, push a car up the hill that five of them could have pushed without me. If I'm pushing along with those other five, I'm part of the cause of the car going up the hill, even though they could have pushed it up the hill without themselves, by themselves. So the idea that you didn't cause the car to go up the hill when you were pushing as hard as you could, because those other five could have done it on their own, that's just mistaken. I'm part of the cause of the car going up the hill. I can be causally responsible for things, even if they would have happened had I not been engaged in them. And then one last point is, I think there are clear cases. As I said at the outset, I'm not a consequentialist. I think consequences matter. They're really important in ethics, but they're not the only things that matter. So imagine the following situation. Imagine there's some small rural town in southern Mississippi or southern Alabama, and they're about to lynch an innocent black man. And the whole town is in on it, including the sheriff and the police officers. Everybody's there, is their plan to lynch this person, and I'm there. There's a lot of social pressure on me to be involved in this lynching and so on. And so they're asking me to put the noose around this person's neck. And of course, if I don't do it, someone else will. This person's going to get lynched whether I participate or not. My putting the noose on the person's neck will have absolutely no causal impact. I mean, it won't change the outcome, right? If I don't do it, someone else will do it. So my thought experiment is, in that case, since it won't make a difference, do you think that I should put the noose on the person's neck and participate in the lynching? And my view is, absolutely not. It's unjust to participate in unjust practices. I would be culpable. I would be guilty. Even if there's nothing I can do to prevent the lynching, I should not be a party to the lynching. I should not be one of the persons who puts the noose on the person's neck. So I, in part, reject the premise that this impotence argument is based on, because I think that not, I actually do think that these things make a difference. So I don't think it's just symbolic. I also think it makes a difference because actually you serve as a role model. Other people see that they can live this way. Just by living this way, you make it more likely you're going to reach the threshold. But I think in addition, it doesn't have to make a difference. It's unjust to participate in unjust practices. And so I think deontologists are right about that. I think consequentialists are right that consequences matter. And I think deontologists are right about that you shouldn't be a party to injustice. Virtue theorists would say the same thing. So that's why I think we don't actually have to have a settled ethical theory. We can draw from the best parts of each of the normative traditions and have these well-justified mid-level moral principles. But I know I stepped on you, Travis. You had a second point you wanted to raise.
Yeah, let me just raise that quickly because I think it ties into the claims that you just made about drawing from the best parts of each ethical theory. So one seemingly empirical fact that would throw a wrench into that is that the thresholds that are met are maybe often good for animal welfare. You might think they are if it results in a fewer number of animals that are being created and then tortured, but they could be bad as well. And Bob Fisher has a, I want to say, nice discussion, but it's a well-informed, detailed, if sad discussion of it in his book, The Ethics of Eating Animals. All right, so suppose that you have a chicken farm that Tyson buys chickens from for you, and you have to meet a certain quota that they give you every month or every couple of weeks or whatever. Then they use that to send it to various grocery stores in the distribution area that your farm's a part of. And one thing that'll happen if enough people stop purchasing chicken in that particular distribution area is Tyson might shut down the farm, or they might order fewer chickens. And maybe the most cost-effective thing to do is to just produce fewer chickens. But another thing that can happen is that you're uncertain about where the demand's going to go when a threshold is met, because it fluctuates. So maybe there's a threshold met where Tyson orders fewer chickens from your farm this month. And one thing you could do to cut costs is produce fewer chickens. But then you worry that maybe the demand will go up next month again, and then you won't be able to sell Tyson as many as they need. You might be fined for that, or you would at least take a cut in your profits. But maybe there's ways that we could produce the same number of chickens at less cost. And then when you introduce cost-cutting measures, that's often not good for animal welfare, as both of you well know, for the audience, could result in ways that produce a lot more suffering for them. So one, I think, empirical complexity surrounding this is not only whether you're a difference maker, but whether when you are a difference maker, the difference is always going to be positive for animal welfare. And it seems like maybe it's not. And if we're taking a risk of causing very serious harm, then at least a kind of self-described standard consequentialist might worry about whether it's good to abstain in those cases.
So first, again, I'll just reiterate, I'm not a self-professed consequentialist, but I do think consequences matter. So it's still an important point to consider. And what I would say is there, and I haven't read the relevant chapter by Fisher, but I would say that it's hard to imagine that you could have much more in the way of cost-cutting, worse treatment for chickens than they currently have, and have the chickens at all survive to make it to market, because the costs have been cut to the bare bone. This is why they're raised. The typical chicken is raised in a shed with 100,000 birds. They're never let outdoors. Automatic feeders, no veterinary care, standing in their own waste and feces, pumped full of antibiotics. They live for 6 weeks. They have less than 1 square foot of floor space per bird. It's really about half a square foot. They're packed together. Their beaks are chopped off with a scalding hot blade so they don't peck each other to death. Many of them starve to death. On average, 10% of the birds die under those conditions. But because they're produced so cheaply, they can afford to lose 10% of the flock each time. So it's pretty hard for me to imagine that you could do much more in the way of cost cutting without it becoming counterproductive to profit, because you just lose an even larger amount of your flock. So again, that's an empirical question. I would have to look at it. I would say that my guess, it's a conjecture here, that those kinds of changes, as long as the demand for meat stayed low, the people who made these changes kept the change, as long as the demand for meat stayed at the low level, eventually some of those farms are going to get shuttered. So there might be a brief increase in animal suffering until it just becomes unprofitable and eventually they have to shut down. And now that shed's no longer producing 100,000 birds every 6 weeks living in total misery. But again, I'd actually have to read carefully the empirical stuff that Bob put together to be able to respond in a more adequate way.
So part of the force of your argument is that you're not relying on a grand moral theory. You want to rely on people's ordinary moral intuitions. And so let's think about what our ordinary intuitions are and taking into account what you've said about not being a party to injustice. So I think the case that you give with putting on the noose, even if it makes no causal difference that the person will still be strung up, has a strong effect, right? I don't want to be the person who plays that role. But think about our other consumption habits. Think about how many items that you own that somewhere along the chain involve some kind of human suffering. So someone who worked in a factory where your clothes were made suffered. And if the idea is, well, maybe I don't want to be the person who works at the factory who's cracking the whip on them and saying you need to work another 8-hour shift, that's one thing, even if someone else would pick up the whip. But to say I shouldn't go and buy the clothes or the books or the iPhone or whatever it is, that's a much, much stronger claim because you're now associated with the injustice. And of course, the difficulty with being involved in a global market is that it's very hard to disassociate yourself from some kind of suffering, some kind of exploitation that's occurred. And you might think that the costs of doing so overall are gigantic. In each particular one, they're not, though. So if I said, you could go and buy these clothes instead of these clothes, or instead of buying Apple products, you buy these products. In each one, it's an imperceptible cost on you. But once we add them all up, you wind up leading the life of a Buddhist monk. And you might say, well, that's not the life that I want to choose. My life matters that I should be able to make certain choices when I'm causing imperceptible harm to others. There should be a sort of choice about what kind of activist projects I get involved in. If you think about the environmental impact of various things. So think about flying overseas. If I say, you are playing some role in the planet dying, so you should never fly again. That seems like quite a cost. Where do you draw this line? So if you want to rely on common sense intuitions, you're saying I'm not a full utilitarian, I think some deontological stuff matters. How do you marry these positions in a way that ties up with our common sense views?
I would say that I think that we should try to limit our complicity with injustice. So if I learn that a particular brand of clothes is made in a sweatshop, I have a choice. I don't have to buy that brand of clothes. I can buy another brand of clothes. And I learn something. So you talked about flying, maybe short of giving up my job or my career, I need to fly various times. But if I'm in a situation where I need to fly, I can buy carbon offsets. There are things I can do to offset the harm that I'm doing. So not in the article that I was drawing from with the Hask Practice article, but in the article that I believe you read, Mark, I talked about that one common sense principle is that we ought to limit our contribution to unnecessary suffering whenever it's easy to do. And it's particularly easy to eat other things because all you have to do is go to the grocery store and right next to the regular cow's milk is soy milk and oat milk and almond milk and whatever kind of plant-based milk you could possibly want. And you just grab the one rather than the other. And it's gotten such, they're almost identical in price. You go and you buy beans and rice instead of meat. Even when you go to your favorite chain restaurants, if you go to, I don't know if these they must have them there, but if you go to a Chipotle restaurant, you get the Sofritos burrito instead of the carne saca burrito. You go to a Taco Bell, you get the bean burrito rather than the beef taco. You go to your Italian restaurant and you get marinara sauce rather than meat sauce. it's so easy to do these things that this is no major, it's not like vegetarians and vegans are eating twigs and seeds. They're eating normal food. They're eating whole fruits and vegetables and beans and nuts and grains. So I don't think it's very difficult at all. Now, to do my job, for example, I actually, just to be doing this with you, I need a computer. I need a fairly high quality computer. And so if the particular company that produced this has bad practices, then I should try to take steps, not buy that product again. As far as driving goes, I think people really should drive hybrid vehicles or electric vehicles when they replace their car, if they can afford it, because these are steps we should be taking. When I say I'm not a consequence, I'm not denying that sometimes the demands on morality are pretty demanding, but I don't think they require us to be saints. I'm not a saint.
This is very helpful. I want to ask just what you would think about a couple of different practices that would result in meat eating in light of these considerations and see what you say about them. So one case is someone that says, okay, yeah, I take your point, but it is hard for me to give up meat for various reasons. Maybe some of the ones I alluded to earlier, maybe something else. But there's all these other sacrifices that I make along all of these other dimensions where I come out overall ahead of most people, even most vegans. So I don't purchase anything that resulted in the exploitation of workers or caused unnecessary suffering. I make my own electronic devices because I have the technical know-how to do that. I have a net negative contribution to the carbon impact of the world because I don't fly anywhere and I bike places and I buy carbon offsets. And I do all these things, but I also eat meat. So that's the first. I wonder whether that would still be okay on your view if they're making the more difficult sacrifices to reduce suffering elsewhere, but not for meat. The second is someone who takes the concerns about causal inefficacy seriously, but say they go to their local Wegmans grocery store and they say, tell me how you decide how much more chicken to order and how much you throw out at the end of the night. And then they tell them whatever their algorithm is for that particular store. Every 100 rotisserie chickens we sell, we order another 100 from Tyson or whatever. And then you go in each night before close and you say, how many rotisserie chickens have you sold? And if they say 99, you're not going to buy it. But if they say any other number, then you buy it. And you know that your purchase in that case is not going to result in any other animal suffering. Now, maybe you want to say that's complicit in a way that your version of deontology that you like should be concerned with. But I'm interested in hearing more about what that amounts to exactly.
I've already addressed that. Can you remind me the first point?
Yeah, the first one is someone that makes a bunch of sacrifices to reduce suffering in other areas except for non-human animal welfare.
You mentioned that this person, it's very unlikely that this person has a net negative carbon footprint if they're eating animal products. Because, for example, if you compare the greenhouse gas emissions of beef to beans, like 49 times greater per 50 grams of protein, the animal products are off the scale in terms of their carbon contribution. And in fact, for most humans, animal products are their even more so than driving, they're their single biggest contribution to carbon footprints, to their own personal carbon footprint. So you would, by shifting from a meat-based diet to a vegan diet, you would reduce your food-related carbon footprint by 50%. So that's fairly significant. But the other thing I would say, This happens. Your question seems a little bit like, why do you worry about animals when there are all these starving humans? I mean, shouldn't you be doing something to help starving humans? Shouldn't you be doing something to help poor people in your own community? And that always seems to me like it's like there's just this limited amount of compassion you have, and if you use it up, you'll run out. But I don't think there's any need to ration our compassion. I can care deeply about starving humans, and I can care deeply about poor people in my own community, while at the same time caring about non-human animals. And in fact, I think in reality, the grains and beans that we're feeding livestock could be fed to the 800 million humans on the planet that are starving to death. But we, people in wealthy countries, choose to have those grains go to farmed animals, with the result that human beings who are supposed to have infinite value, according to human speciesists, are dying right? I mean, it's really unconscionable that we're taking food, perfectly good food that we could be feeding to our fellow human beings, depriving it, not sending it to them, not making it available to those humans, making it available to cow, pig, and chicken farmers instead. I guess there's the two points to that. I think these things are all interconnected, but I also think that I shouldn't ration my compassion in that sort of way. And it's not like vegetarians and vegans hate everything they eat. Their life is miserable. They eat nothing but gruel every day. They eat food that they love, right? I don't know about you, but every vegetarian and vegan I know just is constantly posting pictures of their food all over the place. So I think they're really enjoying their food. And so I just don't think it's a sacrifice to do both. I can limit my driving, drive a fuel-efficient car, eat low on the food chain and high on the ethical one. So I don't have to pick and choose between if I do this one thing, then I can't do that other thing.
So you mentioned that there's a diversion of resources that we could, instead of feeding all these animals, all the grain, could be feeding it to, you know, the hungry. Now, it seems like one of the implications of widespread veganism is that you will have this reduction in terms of the number of animals that are killed, but also in the number of animals that are ever brought into existence. Is there some point where you think that that would be a bad thing? So you can imagine a scenario where we just say, well, if no one wants to eat chickens anymore, then no new chickens are born, no new pigs, no new cows. Maybe you have a small little sort of lot of them because they're like camels and they're exotic and you have zoos. Maybe you think that's too cruel and so you don't have the zoos either. Is it better for those animals never to have been born?
Well, what I would say about, let's just talk about chickens. Chickens are genetic freaks. They've been genetically bred to grow at an unnatural rate. So they typically can't live anything like the normal lifespan of a wild chicken, which is around 10 years, because they grow so fast that they often their bones can't support their weight, and they live miserable lives from start to finish. So it seems to me that yes, it's better for those chickens not to be born at all. Now, one interesting thing, if you imagine what would in fact happen if a significant portion of the population went vegan, there'd be a dramatic reduction in the number of animals produced for food. And that means that we would need to grow far fewer crops to feed them, and that large portions of cropland could be reforested. And so you wouldn't have domestic animals raised in horrible conditions. You would start to have more wild animals living in natural conditions. So I'm not sure you'd have you certainly have fewer animals because the number of animals produced is, it's shocking to think about, right? In the United States, I think it's 9 billion chickens a year. And how do we get that many chickens from the hatchery? Someone has to artificially inseminate every one of those birds. That's someone's job. So there's also a human component. Now, to get 9 billion chickens a year, some group of people have had to artificially inseminate birds enough times to produce 9 billion fertilized eggs that are then hatched in hatcheries and then sent to these farms. So we don't think about where our food comes from and all that's involved in the process. We just see the final product. But the process is unjust from start to finish, from how you mentioned a particular large chicken producer that I won't repeat the name here, but these large companies have brutalized the lives of small-scale farmers, either by forcing them to adopt technology that they couldn't afford and then they're permanently in debt, or basically by running them out of the business. We know there's so fewer small-scale family farms. The injustice permeates the whole. It's not just an injustice towards animals. The farm workers themselves are treated as disposable. The people in the slaughterhouses, they have some of the highest rates of alcoholism and on-job deaths and injuries of any job available. This industry doesn't respect animals, and it also shows very little respect for the human beings that are doing the jobs as well.
Yeah, one thing that puts those numbers in perspective too is I think there's about 8 billion humans on Earth. So just the number of chickens that are created to be raised in factory farms, not even including the male chicks that are ground up and killed right away, outnumbered in the US, outnumbers the total number of humans. It's almost 80 billion terrestrial animals worldwide in factory farms, which greatly outnumbers the human population, sea creatures of various sorts, and the number gets even larger. But I wonder whether it would be a net benefit to have more wild animals that take over the land that humans would not use if hypothetically everybody went vegan. There's a good case to be made that except for maybe some apex predators, the lives of wild animals are really terrible. Maybe net negative, just like animals in factory farms.
I know there are people who make that argument, but and they make arguments that also what we really should do is we should kill all predators. What they worry about is predation. Predation can be cruel and brutal. And there's no doubt, nature red in tooth and claw, right? Survival of the fittest in the wild. Some animals aren't well adapted and or they're very young or they're killed by predators and that's brutal. It's a short-term brutality typically compared to the animals. I mean, most predators, if they do catch an animal, are very effective predators. They kill relatively quickly and the animal was living a life that was normal of its kind until they were killed by prey. That's not true of the animals that we're raising. It's hard for me to believe that the amount of suffering animals in the wild would undergo would even begin to approximate the amount of suffering of animals raised intensively in factory farms. But as for the people who think that we should be out there killing off all predators and, you know, giving birth control to all the prey animals so we don't get overpopulation, I would say if you look at the history of human intervention into wildlife, you know, it's been an absolute disaster, right? When the Forest Service decided it would be a good idea to kill off all wolves, then you got massive deer overpopulation that resulted in large amounts of starvation for those animals. As far as wild animals go, I think we're such poor stewards of the land that we should just, you know, leave the land alone. Some animals were thriving and flourishing. Some animals were being killed off by predators long before human beings appeared on the scene. And there's just tends to be a balance between if there are too many prey animals, then there won't be enough predators and some of those will die out. And you keep a fairly decent balance between the predator and prey animals anyway, without any human intervention. But again, I find it hard to believe that in general, the prey animal have worse lives than a chicken in a factory farm.
So I want to raise a couple of concerns. The one is, I think you make the claim that if there is suffering in the world, that a good person would try and reduce it and a minimally decent person wouldn't participate in it. And so if we accept that in nature, you have this enormous amount of suffering, then the question is what to do about it. And it does seem like mass sterilization would ensure that there's no future suffering, that there are no animals that are killing other animals or predating on each other, that the simplest solution would be, as I say, sterilization of all of them, not killing, because you can say all those animals that are around should be allowed to, you know, live until their natural demise. You know, all their offspring and the countless offspring that will, you know, have these horrible lives going forward because they'll be eaten by other animals or starve to death because of resource shortages. So we can save all of that. So let's sterilize all of them. And some people take that view with regards to, you know, wild cats, for example. They think that the right thing to do is to capture them and neuter them to ensure that you don't have generations of suffering. A related question is this. Imagine someone says, I agree with you. Factory farming is absolutely abhorrent and I will have no role in participating in it. That's why I hunt. And I'm a much, much better hunter than a lion is. So I've got an accurate shot. Every day of the week, I go and practice shooting. And so I can take a deer out with one shot. It doesn't even know that it's dead. By the time that bullet hits the heart, every time I get a perfect shot, there's no suffering in the rearing. You know, I'm doing a better job than the lion. I'm avoiding the cruelty of the factory farming. Surely that must be acceptable. Similar would that arise, let's say, someone who goes out and fishes. So they're not buying fish made by some sort of courier that goes, you know, scraping the bottom of the ocean and killing all sorts of dolphins and other sea creatures. They catch their own fish. Or the latest version of it would be someone who says, I'm going to eat some meat that was made in a vat. It's actual meat. It's cells that are cultivated. Are those things Are they all acceptable? Are they all permissible? Are there degrees of how bad they are?
With respect to hunting and fishing, to come back to what a HASC practice is, it's any practice that harms animals, causes them to suffer, or kills them for no good reason. And there's we have no need for deer meat. We have no need to eat fish. So there's still really no reason to kill those animals for food. Most people that hunt and fish just like to kill. I mean, that's part of what they like to do. I mean, they're getting pleasure out of killing. And of course, some people eat the meat. Some people don't even eat the meat. They just put the trophy on the wall or whatever. And it's estimated that, at least with respect to hunting, for every animal that is shot and retrieved, two animals are shot and not retrieved and end up dying lingering deaths in the wild. You know, hunters aren't as good as they think they are. And if they're trophy hunters, they often try to aim for areas far away from the head, not wanting to spoil the eventual trophy. So they typically won't be hitting vital organs, which will make the death prolonged. A deer living a natural life in the wild has a better life than a factory farm chicken, but I don't think that justifies hunting. You brought up lab-grown meat. And as far as, you know, if your concern is limiting your contribution to unnecessary suffering, once you've collected the various cells needed for the cellular substrate on which to grow the lab-grown meat, then presumably you never have to collect cells again. You have this indefinite source to grow meat in the laboratory on some structure, some cellular gradient type structure. So you wouldn't be contributing to animal suffering by eating lab-grown meat. If there are moral concerns with lab-grown, some people think the fact that you took these cells somehow was wrong. You know, if you were able to collect the cells in a painless way, that doesn't look like a particular wrong. You could grow the meat. If there are ethical concerns with lab-grown meat, I think they would center on the amount of energy required to grow meat in a laboratory as opposed to grow plants with sunlight in fields. Because in a lab, when you're growing this meat, it has to be grown at a certain temperature. Once the meat is produced, it has to be refrigerated or frozen. All of those things require a lot of energy to do. Whereas when you grow beans or rice, you dry the beans, they don't have to be refrigerated. The grain doesn't have to be refrigerated. So, I mean, of course it has to be transported, but so does the lab grown meat. So it looks like the energy profile, the carbon footprint profile of lab grown meat would still be significantly greater than the carbon footprint of eating plants directly. I mean, all of these things, when you eat plants directly, you're eating the most energy efficient foods that there are. So that would be, as far as I can tell, the biggest moral consideration with respect to lab-grown meat, whether there's any, what its environmental impact would be compared to just eating plants directly. Also, I should say, I wish I had these numbers exactly in front of me, but they go something like this. In the United States, I think fruit and vegetable growers receive around $20 billion in subsidies from, $20 million in subsidies from the U.S. government. Animal producers receive $38 billion of subsidies. And it costs an estimated $338 billion of health costs associated with the animal-based foods. If you're growing meat in a lab, it's still going to be a high cholesterol product. And if it's going to taste good, presumably, you're also going to have to figure out how to striate it with fat, which would be saturated fat. And so it would still contribute to heart disease, cancer, stroke, premature death. And collectively, to the burgeoning health costs facing populations. So there would still be other indirect reasons that you might think you really shouldn't be eating those foods, but animal suffering wouldn't be one.
Okay, I wanted to follow up on the considerations around lab-grown meat. One concern is, even if there is a higher carbon footprint, even if it's maybe worse for the environment, it might result in fewer animal deaths and less animal suffering than being vegan and eating fruits and vegetables. Because when you grow fruits and vegetables, you have to have crops that animals get into and then reproduce, and then they often die painful, albeit quick deaths as a result of that. Whereas if you have a lab where there's no land that's habitable for non-human animals, then you don't get that. Now, maybe you say the net benefit for those animals is that they exist as a result of this crop production where they otherwise wouldn't exist. And then they live a good life in premature death. That makes it okay. And I'm sympathetic to that line, but then I wonder whether we should be concerned about the environmental impact of lab-grown meat for the same reason, because then it just gives rise to the non-identity problem for non-human animals. Yeah, maybe it's worse, and for humans too. Maybe it's worse for the environment in some way, but future generations, human and non-human animals, their very existence would depend upon us making lab-grown meat the norm. And as long as their lives are net positive, none of them have been harmed. In fact, they've all been benefited. And there's nobody that matters morally who has been harmed, because those that would have lived better lives just don't come into existence in the first place. So maybe we shouldn't be so concerned about the environmental impact for these reasons.
Again, these are empirical considerations that I haven't fully looked into. But I'll say that if the carbon footprint of lab-grown meat is significantly higher than the carbon footprint of eating plants directly, then given the trajectory that we're currently on with respect to global warming, we would still be contributing to what may actually result in the death of all mammals on the planet by some projections. Stephen Hawking predicted that humans will be extinct in 100 years if we don't learn how to colonize another planet. I mean, he's a smart guy, smarter than me. I don't know if it's true, but and it doesn't take long. You know, you go out maybe a couple hundred years at the rate of climate change that we might not be able to grow food for human beings. And since greenhouse gas people don't typically talk about, water vapor, there's more water vapor in the air just in virtue of the climate being warmer. So we could reach a tipping point where even if we don't put any more man-made greenhouse gases, just the amount of water vapor could make our planet uninhabitable. And some scientists think that's exactly what happened to Venus, why Venus is so much hotter than Mercury, even though Mercury is much to the sun. So I take carbon footprints very seriously, because I think it's an existential threat, not just to human beings, but to all animal life on the planet. It really would depend on what exactly the difference in the carbon footprint is of these two ways of growing